This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A country that is one of the most mineral-rich in the world is also one of the poorest nations in the world. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been rocked by war in recent years, and although the war is over, the conflict and suffering are not over. A Michigan filmmaker is out with a new exploration of how the minerals in our electronic devices are funding the turmoil in that African country. Let's take a listen to this clip from the film's trailer.
Congo is strategically important to the United States.
Cobalt is used in manufacturing weapon systems that are important to the U.S. Department of Defense.
In particular, incredibly rich in coltan, which is really important in electronic equipment.
Yeah, well, these minerals. Congo has been a tempting place to foreigners for a long, long, long time.
Director Mike Ramsdell joins us now. Mike, this film is titled When Elephants Fight. That's the first part of an old proverb. Tell me what it means.
Perfect. Great place to start. When elephants fight is the African proverb. When elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And when looking at the issues of Congo and the complexities of Congo, it seemed to me the most appropriate analogy or metaphor as to the struggling in that country, that since the Berlin Conference, since King Leopold came and declared Congo his own, the history of Congo has been external elephants fighting over the resources in that country and the Congolese people being the grass that's suffering.
And never or rarely, maybe some of the politicians benefiting. The film uses the term conflict minerals, which reminded me of the better known term that we're all familiar with, blood diamonds.
Yes.
Explain what the minerals are and what the conflict is surrounding them today.
I will give you the brief version.
Sure.
And then we can go deeper. Conflict minerals specifically are tungsten, tin, tantalum, and gold. Those minerals are found in pretty much every electronic device we use today, from laptops, cell phones, MP3 players, etc., automobiles, airplanes. The eastern portion of the Democratic Republic of Congo was once called the geological scandal because it is littered with these minerals. Most of these minerals are mined artisanally. They don't have the infrastructure to do the large industrial mining. So what you'll see is when you're flying over or traveling through the country is a hillside with basically a big pit carved out of it and a bunch of individuals with picks and shovels digging these minerals. Now, because of the lack of infrastructure, because of the lack of government oversight, and because of the conflict in the nation, what you can imagine is that those resources are worth a lot of money. And so if you have the weapons, if you have the armed group that controls the area, you control those minerals. It becomes a great interest to control those because those minerals are worth a lot of money. If I control those, I can sell those minerals, I can buy weapons, I can buy political power, etc.
So that's one side of the country. The other side of the country also has minerals, but it doesn't seem to have the same level of conflict. And then the southern part of the country has well-developed processing plants that have been around for a while, but I understand they're also controversial because the government controls and has sold some of that off. So tell us why the different regions are having different issues in the same country.
And that's where the complexity of Congo. Jason Stearns, one of the leading experts on Congo, said that the curse of Congo is its complexity. And that's incredibly accurate because it is a huge country, the largest landmass country in Africa. It reaches basically sea to sea, 11 countries border it. And the infrastructure of the nation, to go back a little bit to the 60s when the Democratic Republic of Congo had its first elected president, Patrice Lumumba.
Right.
Soon
became,
thereafter.
Became
yeah,
independent.
From became the, independent.
Like a lot of African countries
exactly,
in the 60s.
Exactly. And he was unfortunately assassinated, and there's a lot of evidence that the United States and Belgium was behind that assassination. And then a gentleman by the name of Mobutu Sese Seko took over the country, and he was a Western-supported dictator because he was our ally in the Cold War. And Mobutu's strategy to maintain control over the country was very effective. He didn't allow infrastructure to take place, no development of infrastructure, to keep the country separated. Because when people can come together, when they can gather, when they can communicate, when they can convene, their frustrations can mount up. They can mount a coup, whatever it may be. So his thought was, we'll keep the country, keep the regions very separated from each other, and therefore the people will be separated and he would be able to control the country significantly.
So this was by design.
This was absolutely by design, and it was incredibly effective. Unfortunately, since Mobutu fell in 1996, the country has not had the kind of rebound to redevelop any infrastructure or put any in place.
So in fairly recent history, that country has been crossed by a number of different countries' armies. People have suffered those big elephants you've been talking about. I read someplace, I think it was a BBC examination, that nine different countries have trekked across at one time or other with arms to take advantage of some of these mineral deposits or to establish an outpost. That's a real mess. So why isn't the UN or the African Union or somebody else, why haven't they come in there and protected those people and their interests?
Well, that's one of the sadder stories of this. The UN actually has the largest UN ground force in the world in Congo, and it's still not been very effective. Now, you can get into discussions about the efficacy of the UN and their ground forces or the complexity of Congo, and that won't be the topic of our conversation, but they have. And billions of dollars of aid pour into Congo. So it's not that people are turning a complete blind eye. It's that the analogy I like to use is that people are more focused on treating the burn victims than they are on putting out the fire. And that's where When Elephants Fight, my film, comes in, is that I thought, well, it's incredibly important that we at least begin the conversation on what some of the root causes are of this, how we begin to battle this fire, if you will. Now, there's no way that I would say that minerals are the sole cause or the resources are the sole cause of the conflict in Congo. That would be far too simple, and it would be far too easy to fix that. But you cannot look at the history of Congo without using resources as a through thread of the conflict that has torn that country apart. We'll get back to your earlier question. In eastern Congo, you have the artisanal mining that are finding the armed groups and the unsavory characters there. In southern Congo, one of the largest copper belts in the world runs through the southern province of Katanga. And with copper comes cobalt. Now, those are two strategic metals, very essential for not only our industrial military equipment, but also pretty much any piece of electronic equipment built today. This room, I'm sure, is loaded with copper. Those minerals require industrial mining. You have to bring in the big machines. You have to have the know-how. In Congo, based on the Constitution, constitutionally mandated that all the minerals and the resources in the country belong to the people of the country. Congo has some state-owned mining companies, specifically Gécamines, which is its largest mining company, owns all of those concessions. So what they do in theory, and in theory it's a great practice, they don't have the infrastructure to mine, so they work with company X, Y, or Z. That company comes in, they pay, you know, we'll pay you this much money to own this much, we'll mine, and then the revenues will be split between the Congolese people and this company. In theory, that's a great practice. What happens, unfortunately, is that mining company X, Y, or Z, in this case, the film focuses on two mining companies, Glencore and ENRC, will come in and they do business with these gentlemen or with these leaders in an opaque way, in a BVI-based company. Bribes will be paid to whomever, and then the mine will be sold for very, very small amounts of money, maybe 5, 10% of what it's worth. Then whoever owns the mine, whoever it's been sold to, will flip that mine to another external mining company at market value and make up to 800% profits on that. Now, all of that money goes to the company that was able to make the bribe and make the deal in the first place. None of that money goes to the Congolese people. So we're talking about a country that is one of the lowest in the UN index of development. Global Witness and Africa Progress Panel, which is Kofi Annan's organization, did a study in 2014, and they looked at just five deals. And in those five deals, $1.5 billion was lost to the Congolese people. And if you look at that number, $1.5 billion, that's more than double of what the Congolese government spends on health and education in a year. Those profits going to these corporations, these Western-based corporations based in Toronto, based in London, based in New York, are making those profits, are going to shareholders, which maybe your pension is vested in it, maybe, you know, you have to know, but we're profiting off of it. The minerals are going into the products that we're living off of and benefiting off of, and the Congolese people are left with a country that has been racked with war for almost 20-plus years.
So how does a guy born in Flint, Michigan, still lives in the state, how do you get involved in a project like this? What brought it to your attention, and why did you decide this is my next film?
In 2009, I was introduced to Congo by a small nonprofit based in Los Angeles that took me there to take some pictures and make some small videos for them as they were on a fact-finding mission. And once I say that once you get introduced to Congo, you can't un-Congo yourself. It is a juxtaposition of the most extreme. The beauty of the country, the beauty of the people, the mountains are incredibly lush. There's volcanoes. There is the Great Lakes region. So we have the Great Lakes here in Michigan. They have the same thing in Africa. That is juxtaposed against some of the worst human atrocity that you can imagine. Unfortunately, Congo has been called the rape capital of the world. I don't remember exactly the stats, and I think they've changed a bit. But in essence, one woman is raped every 45 seconds.
Rape is also used as a weapon of war.
Exactly right. It was introduced primarily as a weapon of war, and then it's become an epidemic. You have the actual confrontation and the violence, the displacement of the citizens. Refugees are what people know of people who have to flee their country. We recognize that in Syria. In Congo, what you have is IDPs, which are internally displaced persons, where they don't necessarily flee the country. They just flee to a different portion of their country, but live under the same kind of squalor conditions in refugee camps. Over 2 million refugees, IDPs, living in Congo right now. The mortality rate, this war has taken approximately 5.5 million lives. That's the worst human crisis on planet Earth since World War II. So when you get introduced to that, when you look around, when you meet the Congolese people, when you see the beauty of the country, when you see the endless possibility of these resources, and you see this massive amount of suffering, that's almost 6 million people. That's a staggering number and almost impossible to wrap your head around, and yet nobody's talking about it.
Your film, When Elephants Fight, was chosen as the opening documentary for the Edinburgh Film Festival. It'll premiere on Netflix on October the 2nd. What message do you want your audience to take away when they finish watching your film?
It's very clear. It's written right at the end of the movie. Stand with Congo. That's the campaign. What we've done is we've made a film, and we've made a campaign that goes along with the film called Stand with Congo. Go to the website, standwithcongo.org. You can ask for a screening, and we'll send you a copy of the movie. You host a screening. You can sign a petition that will be sent, and that is gathering and being sent to these mining corporations and these electronic companies, saying that we as consumers of these devices and shareholders in these companies want transparency in the dealing in Congo. And it allows us, with that kind of momentum, that allows us the kind of pressure to put on the policymakers, that allows us the pressure to put on the corporations to get the running room necessary to have effective change in the country.
What's the response been so far?
Fantastic. We did a screening just the other day here at the University of Michigan where Dr. Mukwege, who is a Congolese doctor who's done amazing work for survivors of rape and violence, was able to attend the screening, and it was an incredibly powerful evening. We filled the room. There was a very engaged dialogue thereafter, and a lot of people are asking exactly that question, what can I do? And so, more importantly, the steps are all in place that we really want you to take. Stand with Congo.
So the film is When Elephants Fight. It'll be released on Netflix on October 2nd. You can find it there. Mike Ramsdell is a Michigan-based filmmaker, and that is his latest project. Thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thanks so much for having me.